Bianca is back, so that's okay. Well, yeah. First of all, I would like to thank Benjamin and Bianca for inviting me here, or in Benjamin's case, to accompany him here to Canada. And I think some of you might have seen a similar talk by me already. I will just talk to you about how to use tensor network normalization to coarse-grain what we call spinnet models. So this talk nicely ties into what, of course, Gifre told us yesterday, and we'll particularly talk about how you implement these models and how you improve them to make them numerically feasible, and that this improvement is actually by analytical considerations. And it also ties into what Bianca has been talking about in terms of how you can consistently improve like amplitudes of your system, and in this way, like how the dynamics tell you how to improve them. And it also tells you, it ties into Benjamin's talk, where you might at some point see these Ps that he was talking about on the edges. They will very late in the talk reappear again. So yeah. So but this talk is intended for people who would like to try to dabble in a bit into these methods, and I just want to tell you how to realize them. And like before I go into that, just a bit of motivation why we're here, because we want to understand what renormalizing quantum gravity could mean. So we would of course like to understand the relation between quantum gravity or our approach of quantum gravity and whether it has any connection to general relativity. And you could think that your theory of quantum gravity tells you something about the dynamics on the small scales, whatever that's supposed to mean, if you don't have a background structure. And those degrees of freedom that you have there could also have a strong coupling. So perturbation theory is not really an option. So you introduce lattice as a sort of regulator, and that really raises the question of like what happens to diffeomorphism symmetry. So to understand this better, you would like to renormalize your theory and arrive at something which could be the dynamics at large scale. So effective dynamics of many degrees of freedom. Do they allow a description of a smooth manifold? And you should better get diffeomorphism symmetry back. But still, the relation to VR is not really known. So I think renormalization gives you the chance as a consistency check on the right-hand side, because of physics, to understand whether this is actually a quantum theory of classical gravity. And on the left-hand side, for your theory, what are the choices that you make, and how are basically things, how are these choices actually related? What happens if you make a different choice, and how does that influence our method, our outcomes here at large scales? And like many crucial questions in this, and I think renormalization techniques can help us to tackle these questions, but what I want to convey in this talk is that you will need both numerical and analytical methods to attack those questions. And as an example, I will talk about tensor network renormalization, which is originally something from Hannes meta theory. So first developed by Levin Naef, Gwynne Wen, and Gifre told us yesterday about yet another algorithm. It is a numerical tool to study systems, to efficiently study systems with many degrees of freedom. So the idea is that you coarse-grain an abstract tensor network which encodes the dynamics of your system, and you evaluate the partition function and you approximate the partition function in the step basically in parts. And then you can study effective dynamics at a coarser scale. And what's very interesting for us, a priori, this network does not care about a background structure. So there is no reference at all. And we've applied this successfully to so-called analog spinform models, what are called spin nets. What all these papers are about, I'll talk to you later. And in the talk after the Clément will tell us about applications of that towards lattice gauge theories. But the purpose of my talk is I will explain the algorithm in detail for the easing model today, sort of as a take-home example. So if you want to try it yourself, you can start Mathematica and try to basically examine that yourself. And yeah, there are lots of analytical improvements to make the numerical investigation feasible. And in the end, you will see why I will have to use all those improvements. And of course, we don't want to study the easing model, but look at a system which we have no understanding about a priori. And this is from a paper of mine from this summer, where I looked at just some easing model on a background. What this means is not important, but it's just we want to look, uncover the different phases of spin form models, understand their geometrical meaning, and look at phase transitions. And if a phase transition of second order, this could be a natural way of going towards a continuum limit. So this brings me now to the plan of my talk. This was a bit of the motivation. Afterwards, I will explain basic algorithm of tensor network renormalization. So in detail, I will present again, after yesterday, how to define this as a tensor network, and then I will describe the algorithm. And then I will show that there are several problems with this algorithm if you basically ignore the symmetries. So I will show how you explicitly preserve the symmetries in this algorithm. And then I will go to something which I call the triangular algorithm. And all these steps are necessary if you want to go beyond the easing model, in particular for spinners for large groups. Large groups still means finite or quantum groups, but like with lots of indices going around. And then I will just present a short summary. So, right. Yesterday we've already seen the easing model. I will just briefly introduce it again. We're looking at a 2D square lattice, and on each vertex of my lattice there will sit a small easing spin, which can point either up or down, and this will just be the variable 0 or 1, and the group operation is just the sum modulo 2. The lattice also encodes how these easing spins talk to one another via so-called edge weights. Just this omega e is given by this function, is just the Boltzmann weight, and beta is the coupling constant. And then the partition function of the system is just I have a product over all the edge length of these edge weights, and I sum over all configurations that these spins might have. So what I want to do now is I want to encode this in terms of a tensor network. So I would like to describe this partition function over here as a tensor trace of this network, which is just a contraction of the tensors according to this network. And Keith explained to me yesterday how to do this in one way. I will show a different way today. So he basically had a tensor network which just had tensors sitting here and then going diagonally through these spins. I do an intermediate step and perform a Fourier transform of the system down to this system down here and then go back to the tensor network. And we'll be straightforward what tensors are then going to be. So first I do the Fourier transform. So these edge weights omega e, because they are functions of an abelian group, they are actually class functions, so invariant under conjugation. So I can into characters. It's just an abelian group, so like there are just two representations, k equals 0 and 1. So the character is actually just the exponential I pi k times g, where k times g is just a scalar multiplication. And because it's an abelian group, the character of two group elements is just the product of these two characters. So I can now expand all the edge weights in my partition function according to these rules. And the nice thing is because the characters factorize, and they are now the only functions that actually contain information on the group elements, I can order them now according to the vertices and pull the summation of the group elements in. And I can perform the sum over the group elements. And this object then just is actually just the delta function on Z2. And it just tells you that, well, now I have representations k sitting on my edges. And it tells you that all the representations that basically meet at this vertex have to sum to 0. In other words, these four representations have to couple to the trivial representation. So that would be important if you talk also about non-abelian case. Yeah? It's exactly that. So I think Zavit wrote it. I'm not sure it was the first one, but it's like, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's even more stuff that you can do. It's just you can do another transformation of this system and go back to an easing model on the dual lattice, which is then just inverted temperature because the easing model is self-dual. Yeah. Okay. Well, but this is not, like, for now, this is not important. We just have a completely different partition function. We still have, like, the Fourier transform edge weights on the edges, but delta functions on the vertices. And I want to express this object in terms of a tensor network, and there's just a very natural thing to do. So the tensors are just these four-valent objects in my network over here, and I just choose them to be, well, to contain the delta function on the one hand, and then the only thing which is left to do is just split these edge weights, is just take the square root. So this is my new tensor network, and if I now plug two of these tensors together, you see that the edge weight is, again, of course, just a normal omega k, and I get the same partition function. And just, again, connecting just means summing over these shared indices. And if you want to implement this in your code, this T is just basically a four-dimensional array, so just a collection of numbers which is 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. And that's rather straightforward and doesn't seem to be very large at first. So, right. So now I have a tensor network, and now I want to perform something which is called tensor network renormalization, which is just a local manipulation of my tensors to encode the same partition function in terms of a coarser tensor network. And here it just means a local manipulation of my tensors. Here it is a certain splitting of the four-valent tensor into two three-valent ones. And then I basically contract over these smaller, finer degrees of freedom, and I get a new effective tensor. And this splitting is actually done by a singular value decomposition, and that is like a very natural choice to do, which I will explain now. So the first thing I have to do is, to perform the splitting, I have to reshape my tensor into a matrix, because I can only apply an SVD on a matrix. So what I just do is just, I group, yeah?
That's generalizations of SVDs for tensors or something. Like, if you drive them, are they
using a matrix? I'm not really aware, but I don't think you have such nice theorems about these generalizations. Because for the SVD, they give you the best reconstruction of a matrix you can have if when a certain truncation.
Yeah, and these. Like
yeah. And it just appears to me that if you want to have like higher dimensional splittings, you just perform many singular value decompositions. So I don't know. But yeah. But just the idea is just I group the indices of my tensor together to form two pairs of indices. So here it's very symmetric. I just take two representations and put them together into one large index, which just means I go through the values of these indices and write them as a matrix. So what you get in this case is just this simple thing here. So you go just through the possible values that your indices can take, and you only have non-vanishing values here and here, just according to the delta function. So because here, as you see, 0, 0, and 0, 1, they don't sum up to 0, modulo 2, so this value is vanishing. And if you want, like, depending on the programming language, you can either do this by hand by just going through the values of your array, or you have mathematically something which is called array reshape. So you can just reshape your tensor into a matrix. Right. And now, given this matrix, I will perform a singular value decomposition. So if you first think about this, the Hermitian matrices MM dagger or M dagger M, you can diagonalize these matrices. So the matrices U and V are unitary. The eigenvalues of these matrices are all real and positive. And it turns out that you can actually decompose any matrix into something which is like U, a diagonal matrix lambda, and V. So this U is actually then called the left singular vectors of M. V are called the right singular vectors of M. And the lambdas are basically just the square roots of the eigenvalues of this matrix up here. And the very nice thing is, first of all, this decomposition over on this hand side is exact. Because I have a 4 times 4 matrix, I in principle have 4 non-vanishing singular values. And these singular values are ordered in size. So lambda 1 is the largest, and then they just become smaller and smaller. Now, what I've done here, I've made a truncation. So I just say, I just take the first largest two singular values and reconstruct, approximate my matrix M1 like this. So why is this a good choice? Well, there's a theorem telling me that the reconstruction of a matrix from a truncated SVD, in this case, is actually the best approximation of this matrix by another one of rank 2. So this approximation means in the least square error. So we will see why this is important later on. But don't think, if you want to realize this, that you have to program an algorithm for a singular value decomposition yourself. So most programming languages come with something already which is much better than you can come up with in finite time. So, or you have to look for additional libraries like in C++. But what is this good for? Well, if I go back and think about where this matrix originally came from, I can use this like basically to split my tensor. So if I do not truncate, I can approximate my tensor I had before by two three-valent ones, which are then connected by this new edge, which carries the label of the singular values. And the important thing will be that I will interpret this label I sort of as my new degree of my new effective degree of freedom on a coarser scale. So what these maps U and V tell me, they are basically a map from the finer degrees of freedom to the coarser degrees of freedom. Depending on the way you read them, you could call them a projection map or the other way around, an embedding map. So because like the SVD also tells me how important these degrees of freedom are, it's essentially the dynamics which tell me which degrees of freedom are the important ones on the coarser scale. And I can also make a transform, like narrow this truncation and just say, on the coarser scale, I just want the two most important degrees of freedom. So I arrive back at something which looks similar to my first tensor. Right, so I do this by basically defining three valent tensors from this U, V, and the singular values. And again, this I are now my new coarse degrees of freedom. Then as a last step, the thing is left to do is I have to sum now over these fine degrees of freedom. So I plug these three valent vertices together, sum over what is in between. There are some good ways to do that, but in the programming language, but this is like not really important, but I get a new effective tensor T prime. So that actually completes one iteration of the tensor network algorithm. I'm back again at a square lattice, and now I can iterate the procedure until I arrive at a fixed point. So what happens then for the easing model? So despite I've made this crude approximation that I just take two singular values, I do find a phase transition at the wrong critical temperature between something which is called the disordered phase and the ordered phase. So the disordered phase is characterized by one non-vanishing singular value, as Giffre has told us, and because there are no correlation between the easing spins. And then there's the ordered phase, where you have two non-vanishing singular values of equal size, which just means all easing spins are parallel and can point up or down. And close to the critical temperature, you find almost scale invariance. So therefore, a very long time, your tensor, you renormalize, will stay the same. And then eventually it will converge either to disordered or ordered phase. But what we do not get from this is like what the meaning of these singular values actually is, right? Because we know the easing model very well, but just imagine that you look at a new model you have no idea about, and then you find different phases with different numbers of singular values. What do they mean? To which degrees of freedom do they correspond to? Which brings me to the first improvement of the algorithm about the symmetries. So like there's a significant difference in after one renormalization step already. Even though this new tensor I have has the same index range because of the choice I made, this tensor here depends on that two representation labels, whereas on the right-hand side, I just have labels of singular values. So as I said, these U's and V's that you get are variable redefinitions. They map K1 and K2 into some generic label I. Now, just imagine that you do 17 of these iterations. You have 17 variable redefinitions. And you try to understand again what these correspond to. Well, you have to keep track of all U and V's and then reconstruct all the way back to your initial variables, which is quite horrible. And then you think again, you had delta functions on your vertices. So if you have many of these tensors together, like, and we would just naively sum over what is inside, you still have a delta function of many variables, but this must be somewhere. And it's actually hidden in the meaning of degrees of freedom labeled by this I. So can we do something better? Can we preserve the symmetries of this tensor under coarse graining and also use it to use less resources and less computational time? And in fact, we do. In fact, we can. Just if I just reorganize the indices of the matrix according just to this, you see it can be of a block diagonal form, where this block basically tells me, well, these variables over here, they couple to an intermediate representation, which is zero, and like these two as well, and the same down here. But they couple to an intermediate representation one. So what we have to do is we have to exploit the delta functions. We can split the delta functions of four arguments into two delta functions with three arguments and introduce an intermediate variable k, which corresponds basically to, like, by hand splitting like this. But what we do is basically we turn our tensor into just smaller bits, where we just say our variables couple to an intermediate label k. So what we then, because of this, we can just say, well, we only compute the components of the outside variables k, which are actually compatible with this intermediate variable. And as a result, we just get this matrix, or we just get, basically, we get this matrix and this matrix. So we have now two 2 times 2 matrices. So we have to perform just one SVD for this matrix. But so we have to perform more singular value decompositions, but we have smaller matrices, which will become later much more important if you go to much larger symmetry groups. And our approximation now is just, which is still very crude, we just take one singular value for each of these blocks. So I will always call this k either blocks or maybe intertwiner channels or something like this. But this is, of course, first of all, a very big improvement because we save less data. And we also use less computational time. Why is that? Well, if you perform the splitting, our three-dimensional tensors are again proportional to a delta function. So if we then plug everything together, we have 4 delta functions, and we want to sum over these 4 variables. So essentially, if you then use some delta functions again, you just have to sum over 1 variable. And your new tensor is again explicitly proportional to a delta function which has 4 elements. So you can do the same trick again. You can just save the block diagonal elements of this new tensor again. So you have now a different renormalization group flow in terms of tensors with these symmetries. So due to our approximation, we now have another tensor which has the same interpretation, the same size, and a very similar form to our initial TK. Right. And this helps us into the interpretation of the phase transition. So, well, still we have a crude approximation. Still we get the wrong phase transition temperature, but we understand better what's going on. So the disordered phase is then characterized by one non-vanishing singular value just in the block k equal to 0. So in other terms, the only the representation k equal to 0 is allowed, which actually matches the initial model for infinite temperature for beta equal to 0. And the ordered phase has 2 non-vanishing singular values of equal size, one in block k equal to 0 and one in block k equal to 1 with equal weight, which matches the initial model for beta going to infinity. And this is like something we would call this is some like the analog of BF theory for the system, in the sense that if you go back to the spin picture, it just means that all your edge weights are evaluated on the identity. And then you Fourier transform, it just gives you the maximally spread something in the Fourier space, which is just these two representations being equally excited. So now, due to this explicit symmetry preservation, we have also obtained a good interpretation for our model. Right. And there is now one last step, which is, has nothing to do with interpretation, but more with the numerical feasibility, which is going towards a triangular algorithm, which I will just briefly talk about on 2 slides. So if you just think about this algorithm that we had, at some stage we have 4 3-valent tensors, and we sum over these intermediate indices, and we get a new effective tensor here, and in the next step we split it again. So maybe we can like cut a step out, and instead of just gluing everything together and splitting again, we just say we take 2 3-valent tensors, we put them together, and define some kind of an embedding map to a new effective degree of freedom here, and get a new effective 3-valent tensor instead. So this is what I've been working on mostly in during the last year of making this algorithm possible. I will just be very brief about this. So the first step is, of course, if you use 3-valent tensors in contrast to 4-valent tensors, you just have to save much less data. So first of all, you have to store less memory. And in this process, you compute, again, 1 4-valent tensor from 2 3-valent ones. And what you do is here, you perform a singular value decomposition now with respect to the coarse variables, let's say these edges over here and the edges over here. And from that, you get an isometry, what Yves has been talking about yesterday. And you plug this in to define a new effective edge, a new effective degree of freedom. And of course, you also do the symmetry preserving, which is like the most important, well, which is quite an important part, because to get now basically 1 block of this new 3-valent tensor, you just have to compute 1 block of the new 4-valent tensor. So you do not have to store an entire 4-valent tensor again, but just some part of it. So First of all, you save memory because you have smaller building blocks, and then you use the symmetries to reduce like the amount of data you have to store just to what is necessary in this particular time step or in this particular iteration step. Right. So to sum up these improvements, so first I talked about just tensor network renormalization as this. Hmm? Yeah. Well, you can also do it in this in the algorithm by that I described before. But you have to go to you have to basically store the three valent ones. Like you can never save the four the full four valent tensor at a single time. Right? You can. I think in principle it's also possible. Yeah, but it's basically the same thing as here. So. Yeah, it is. You can do the same thing. I'm sure of that. But yeah. But like, I mean, if you just go from here to here, it is more straightforward, and it does the job. So at the end, yeah. Of course, you can also try just to compute one block of this one and then go to the next step. But yeah, I think it's practically the same possible. But yeah. Right. So just to sum up, like, tensor network renormalization was just this cross-grain algorithm with a very controlled truncation scheme, and the singular value decomposition tells you how to map fine degrees of freedom to coarser degrees of freedom and how relevant these are. Then I introduced this explicit symmetry preservation because it allows you to only compute, store, and sum over the non-zero parts. And you get the interpretation of your tensors in terms of the original variables. And as a last step computationally was this triangular algorithm, which works with smaller building blocks and only computes what is really necessary just in one particular step of the algorithm. So you're wondering, well, it's just the easing model. What do you need this for, right? It's just like the matrices you were looking at were maybe 2 by 2, and then you have two of them. But what's the big deal? Well, we want to go, of course, beyond the easing model and just talk about spin nets. So just a short history of that. So you can imagine spinnet models to be like, I call them analog spinform models because they share certain statistical properties. You can imagine the easing model basically being the, like the easing model in two dimensions is sort of related to Z2 gauge theory in four dimensions. And basically from the perspective of spinform models, you remember that Benjamin was talking about these operators PE on the edges, where this PE has indices according to how many faces are meeting at this edge. So these PEs in spinnet models are actually living on the vertices, and they should carry indices according to how they connect to the other indices of your network. And to give you a flavor of how long it took us, or how it was for us developing these algorithms, like the symmetry preserving four-valent algorithm was actually the first time applied in 2011 by Bianca, Frank Eckert, and Mercedes Martin Benito, and for abelian finite groups at Q, and then over the time it was improved to tackle non-abelian finite groups, also again with the work of Erik Schnetter, and I basically jumped on when it was about quantum groups in SE2K. And well, I worked together with Bianca on actually developing this triangular algorithm, mostly motivated because you want to look at something which is called, which we call analog Barrett-Crane models for SE2K cross SE2K, which we also started like last year with a summer student, Cameron Seth, and Florian Girelli here at Waterloo. And I myself did a work on an easing model, which is coupled to a dynamical SE2K background. And if you want to study this model here, it will actually turn out that all the optimizations that I described before are actually necessary to make this feasible at all, to make it actually work. And because I do not have time to explain all the technicalities, here's just a dictionary. So on the here's the easing model. There is the SE2K cross SE2K spinnet models. So your initial tensor in the easing model is basically just a delta function. For the spinnets, it's a bit of a more complicated object, like this P, which depends on actually here eight representations. And these eight representations come with two sets of magnetic indices. If you try to store this, well, the easing model is just 2^4 entries. And this thing is monstrous. I think there should be also a product here. But it's just imagine, like, for each of those representations, you have the just the dimension of this vector space, and then you have to go through all the values that these representations can take up to the maximum value of the quantum group. So this is just, if this Jmax is too large, it's just too large to save this entire object. So okay, let's try to do this in the symmetry preserving way. So what there is for the easing model is just this TK that I talked about. And for SC2K cross SC2K, these intertwiner channels are actually labeled by four representation labels and still depend now just on the representation labels, because you basically take care of the dependence on the magnetic indices. So that's already a huge gain, but you have to deal with a lot more blocks, a lot more intertwiner channels in comparison to the easing model. So there you just have two. Here you have basically the maximum spin plus 1 to the power 4. So if you go to k equal to 6, which has a maximum spin of 3, I just talk about the integer spins, you have 256 blocks. If you want to do k equals to 8, you have 625 blocks. And then what is the largest matrix that you have to actually decompose by the singular value decomposition? In the easing model, it's 2 by 2. For k equal to 6, it's 8 to the 4 times 8 to the 4. And for k equals to 8, it's 13 to the 4 times 13 to the 4, which is already 12 gigabytes of memory that you just have to store somewhere. So it probably won't run on your notebook anymore. And this already includes that we just save, in terms of a super index, all those representations that are actually like, we use the coupling rules of the quantum group to just save those couplings that are actually allowed. And the same holds for the 6J symbols. So at some point during this algorithm, we have to also use sum over 6J symbols. And we just sum over those. We only compute those, save, and sum over those which are actually non-vanishing.
So 12 gigabyte is for the full tensor?
No. No, the full tensor is in this... Yeah, the full ten, yeah, a single block. That's why the triangular algorithm is important. The four valent one, you, I think, for this. Okay. Help. Was it? Seems to be okay again. So, just no. It seems to be on there. Well, no. This is just for the largest block. Okay. If you try to save the entire tensor, this needs 20. I think more than 20 gigabyte. This, I think more than 100. If you would save the entire tensor, like this doesn't run here on Titan. So. This gave Eric nightmares, I think. Trying to distribute that on different nodes. So. Right. So far I just talked about the analytical optimization. So with all these optimization in place, in principle you can run this k equal to 6 code, which just has these blocks of just a quarter gigabyte. You can run that on your notebook. Well, if you'd run it in Mathematica and you don't need your notebook for anything else, you can just try this for 1 week. So optimization of the code is required too. And if you don't know, if you're not too familiar with that, ask for help. Inquire about the computational facilities at your university or institute. For example, here at PI, we have this Titan HPC facilities where one node has 12 CPUs and 96 gigabytes of memory. And after parallelization, where Eric helped us a lot of like the same stuff in C++ took just 6 hours for 30 iterations. And then once you have that, you have to scan through the parameter space of your model, which for the Eason model is just the coupling constant beta. But if you want to go even higher to higher quantum groups, you have like it doesn't even work on Titan anymore, because then your largest block is like 120 gigabytes large. So of course, like if you want to realize numerical simulations, you always have to put lots of analytical work into it to make them feasible at all. But this gives you already this indication that I think just making stuff larger doesn't really, at some point you run into another wall. And I think that just numerical methods will not be able for you to go beyond, not to mention even like just compact Lie groups. So I think you will have to foster also analytical methods together with numerical methods to go beyond this. which brings me now also to like the summary of my talk. So I try to give you today an in-depth presentation of how to do tensor network renormalizations for these, for the easing model most likely. And there are many analytical improvements that went into this, the explicit symmetry preservation to get the interpretation and just compute like smaller tensors, like just the non-vanishing objects in your tensor. And then the second optimization was the triangular algorithm, which reduces the memory usage significantly. And like the motivation for us to do this was, of course, that we wanted to study these very complicated SpinNet models for SA2K cross SA2K. But my take-home messages are, like, I think numerical methods are a promising tool to advance quantum gravity, but they just by themselves are not enough. In particular, if you want to talk about Lie groups, we can't just do a tensor network with infinite index range, so we have to come with something which is like implementing both analytical and numerical techniques, so they have to supplement each other. Where the one fails, the other should try to help out, whatever this is supposed to mean. And in particular, we have to develop like new tools like which use both of them. So that brings me to like the last slide, and I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this nice counterexample to this statement, shut up and calculate. Apparently, that's not always a good suggestion. Are there any questions?
No, I did calculate. You just have to calculate.
No, the point is that you didn't just put everything on a computer. No, you thought and you simplified the problem, and that's why the calculation didn't take that long. I think that's the take-home message here. Anyway, are there more questions? So I have a question. Sorry, what's that?
So when you have these different steps, do you keep your k constant, like for the quantum group k's, or do you change more?
No, you keep k constant. This, I mean, the
yeah.
k of the quantum group.
Yes.
You keep this constant. Yeah. You keep this constant. Yeah.
So is there the possibility to maybe say, okay, in the second step or after 10 steps, this k changes in some sense as you want to renormalize the cosmology of the constant? So the k at the micro scale is maybe not the same as in a very large scale.
So we had some idea to do that, but then the idea would be to start at a certain k and put a dynamics which would implement a larger cosmological constant, and the flow there through fixed point.
Yeah, and identify this fixed point as something which could live in a smaller quantum.
In some sense, this happens because even if you start with, you know, if you start with a larger k, like the f in this k would be that all blocks are excited, and you flow to fixed points where not all j's are excited. So in this sense, it works, but it's given the symmetry reduction, it's difficult to change the symmetry group in the middle of the calculation.
And I think the other thing is like the fixed points are still slightly different, whether you have like the same sort of like qualitative fixed point in the sense that in the smaller quantum group where certain number of spins are excited, and then in the larger one where you have the same spins excited, the quantum dimensions are different. So these tensors are still different.
You could not put in the symmetry reduction and then, you know, it can flow to anything. But the problem is you lose kind of all interpretation and health you have, all this memory saving and so on. And so this is kind of more dynamical, but then at the beginning you would have to put, the problem is that the initial data is so large. And even the representation of the fixed point, like the F theory in principle, even this fixed point has infinite one dimension. It's hard to, you know, that's just this representation.
Computer with infinite quantum dimension,
this language.
Yeah. I think Mark, you had a question.
Yes, in the beginning you said that with your first algorithm you obtained the wrong critical temperature for the easing model.
Yeah, you like also with the other one you get the wrong one. This is just to get the right one you have to take more singular values into account. So I just skip this part because it would take me more time to explain this, but
Also, just want to clarify that you get the not the right result.
The problem, I mean, it's an approximation to the point, but it's not the I don't know by 7% or something. It was like
I think it was 0.39.
No, by 7% you computed the percentage of that.
Percentage was
7 or 10%.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't too much, which is, but.
And he went to front dimension, I don't know, 40, 64 or something.
I think at some point 60, but
So it is.
I mean, depending on who you ask, some people say, well, you shouldn't truncate at all because you change the partition function because of this. And if you have to truncate, what you should actually do is, and I think I tried this at some point for something smaller, but what you have to do is you first compute the singular values.
Can you change the line to vector?
Change the line.
So what you should do, like you basically make a list, and then you make here the singular value, and then you have a list just for the easy one, you have just 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and then just like, normally this is then normalized to 1, and then this is like, say, 0.8, this is 0.6, this is 0.59, and then it goes on and on, and what you then at some point like should do, like you, like, if you haven't truncated, like you get many singular values, and let's say, and here you're at 0.00 blah, and then you say, oh, this is not important, I truncate here and just take all those singular values, all those singular values with me. So what you then have is a tensor which still has this interpretation with these representation labels, but they appear multiple times. So there are like many, like more degrees of freedom hidden in there. And I think Eric is like looking a bit scared.
No. The more problems, the more secure my job gets. So.
that's okay. That's a nice way to see it. So no, but like this is of course the way you should do, and you have to be very careful in like which singular values to truncate. So for example, to truncate here would be quite bad because these two singular values, I mean, they are less important than the most important ones, but they are very similar. Right, and in these truncations, it sometimes can happen that if you look at, and it's like, then the stuff can become pathological, really, if you look at like two singular values, which then, like here you have the number of iterations, and they would like two singular values from the same channel, which at some point cross. Then it becomes very pathological because if they cross, in this crossing point, you suddenly, from one iteration to the next, get a different degree of freedom, which is like a different embedding map, which completely changes the flow of your model. So if you truncate wrongly, you get something which is very bad, like which is then really non-physical. So in that situation, you shouldn't truncate. And I think there was something in your work, Bianca, with Frank and Mercer, like. That you should never, if you increase the number of singular values from one block you take, you should never decrease them during your flow.
Your punk had this adaptive thing where you would always increase just some one dimension.
So, like, there's more stuff hidden behind this, but if I just imagine that I would have, of the 625 blocks, compute many singular values and just take, then of those take the most 1,000 important, like, I don't know whether that's, I have no idea how to do that, so.
The question is, if you can take 620 blocks, it's useful to compute only with 15.
Yeah. Well, I myself look at something which looks, which is like a EPRL model, kind of, for SE2, cross SE2, and there it is, one singular value per block does not seem to work anymore. But this is just super preliminary, so. Yeah, what?
How much does these techniques depend on the geometry of the graph that you're using? So, for instance, the valency of these nodes, where the tensors
So do you have to invent a new kind of, I mean, the contraction and splitting depends on the validity of the
script. Or just the just what kind of letters you have. Like normally these are all for regular networks. You can have one, for example, for the honeycomb letters where you would identify those the transformations that you make as Pachner moves, basically. But I think the easing model depends on the valency of stuff. But
so I mean, then you would compute a different thing. But for each regular, I mean, it's much for this computational stuff. It's much better to take a regular path. From a simple perspective, I wouldn't really know. What, I mean, why? Answer this initial question, I should pick any level of that. Because then you, I mean, the idea is you save only one tensor. I mean, you have a homogeneous thing, you just need to save one tensor. If you have an inhomogeneous thing, you need to save in principle a tensor for each node. You can do that if you want, but we have already saved one tensor.
And this is like exactly what Bianca is saying, because it's the same tensor everywhere, I just have to keep track of one. I split it into different ways and just have these four. So it's very, very local, and it's intended, the algorithm is intended to be and stay local.
In
so,
a two-dimension, I think you can probably think of any letters, and for any regular letters you can think of an algorithm. Then 3D and 4D, I think they're kind of maybe huge differences or big differences and how much saving stuff and how much you need to save and the efficiency and the use of that. Just counting the release of Hedron, the tetrahedron and the cube relative to 4D simplex and the hypercube are hugely different.
And I think there's
the simplex is much deeper. But then the regular letters with simplexes.
But the first step is always the same. So reshape tensoring to a matrix, so to group indices.
Yeah,
so
the principle is always the same.
Something.
This is a cheap, this is a much, you know, stupider thing what get presented. But it is always the same to try to put either, I mean, there were two versions, either split the thing, which is to get this embedding map, or to compute in the triangular algorithm. We didn't need it to split, but we were computing these embedding maps, and it's always SVP.
But this particular triangular algorithm is implicitly also on a square lattice, because you assume that your triangles have a rectangular angle somewhere. But
actually,
besides
each,
that,
each step you make the same thing.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
Map the results at each step between these two algorithms, just like this. It's more intelligent.
And it's much more cost efficient. So, but I think there's also a different paradigm, because like in tensor network, like in, for the easing model, you always use it as a test bed for how accurate your algorithm can be. So you want to get the correct phase transition temperature up to a certain degree. We do not know if a spinform model has a phase transition and for which parameter like this would occur. So Wolfgang, if you give me like if I would be able to crosswind your spinform model, and it would look at different triangulations, let's just assume I could do it, it would probably be like depend on like the actual like value of the parameter would depend on what kind of lattice I would choose. But this is not really like important information, because like whether it's 0.5 or 0.7 doesn't really matter. It's more about the qualitative statement, so that there is a phase transition and like this is like. Like you can really identify what this corresponds to, like the different phases and what happens at this transition.
Any more questions? Right, if not, then let's thank the speaker again.